Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, and potentially you guys
don't know a damn thing about it.
So this is part two of our coverage of Robert Berdella, also known as the Kansas City Butcher, and honestly probably one of the most sadistic serial killers in history. If you haven't listened to part one, listen to that one to be inclined. We're going to do a quick recap, but you will get a better understanding of just how much of a monster this dude is if you listen to part one.
It's a really, really rough story, so just be prepared.
It is a very rough story, so it is really hardcore. This dude did so many horrendous and horrific acts to multiple young men, and that was his whole point in everything he did. So in part one, we went over Robert's early years and his first three murders, which all got progressively more sadistic as he quote-unquote perfected his M.O. And when we last left you at the end of part one, Robert was brought in for questioning for the disappearance of his first victim, 19-year-old Jerry Howell. However, he was quickly let go, and by this point, he had successfully gone away with the torture, murder, dismemberment, and disposal of three young men. Now, one interesting thing to note from part one is that Robert was kind of a unique serial killer in the fact that he never actually set out to murder anyone, so he says. So he seemed to be very open and candid with the police after he was caught, because, spoiler alert, he was obviously caught. But he always maintained that he never set out to kill any of his victims, because for him, that would defeat the purpose and why he started torturing them in the first place. He was a sexual sadist, and he got off on causing as much pain as possible to his victims, so them dying would completely defeat the purpose of him wanting to keep them captive and torture them and make them his sex slaves. So he always maintained that all of his victims were never intended to be murdered, and that all of them simply died just from how extreme his torture methods were. And again, if y'all haven't listened to part one, he is extreme in his torture methods.
Yeah, death is actually a release from what this guy does. Like, I hate to say it, I hate that anyone died, but like, I would much rather die than go through what he done to these poor men.
And yeah, it is so horrific, and that's what got Robert off. The more screams of agony from his victims and when he tortured them is what made Robert excited, and that's what gave him sexual satisfaction. He actually hated it when they died because it meant he could no longer hear their screams or torture them. His ultimate goal was to have a young man as his captive sex slave, someone he could routinely torture and assault for years, or just until he got bored. However, the tortures he inflicted on these young men were so extreme and brutal that all of his captives died within 3 days, passing away from their extensive torture. Now, Robert also kept detailed journals and Polaroids documenting all the horrific torture he inflicted on his victims, writing down what he did to them and how they reacted in pain. He noted which forms of torture caused the most pain in order to remember them to try out on later victims. He took photos of his victims bound and gagged, and their reactions whenever he was torturing them, such as hooking alligator clamps to their testicles and shocking them. He frequently masturbated over the images and often fantasized about new ways he could torture people. And by the end of the last episode, Robert had actually took a small break from killing, like a couple of months, in order to quote-unquote perfect his methods of torture. He realized his current methods were so extreme and brutal that he was killing his captives way too quickly for his liking. He wanted to devise ways to cause his victims pain without killing them. So after about 3 months after his last victim, Robert finally felt that he had devised the best technique, and he was excited to try it out on a new victim. And that is where we left you in part one. So, let's just jump right into it and pick up where we left off, as Robert began the hunt for his fourth victim. And again, trigger warning, this is going to be a very extreme and rough episode. Very graphic talks of torture, sexual assault, and just some of the worst acts committed on young men that you'll ever hear. So this is a very rough case, but again, this is the truth. This is what happened. So Robert had successfully fooled police into believing he had no connection to Jerry Howe's disappearance, and he was once again off the hook for now. Because just a few weeks later, Robert was again be questioned by police, but not for any murders. So like we talked about in part one, Robert was very well known amongst the gay sex workers in Kansas City, and he had relationships with most of them. Now, although he did develop a reputation for rough sex, he was also known to be very generous and often allowed hustlers to live at his home, and he supplied them with money and drugs whenever they needed it. So many hustlers still often sought him out whenever they were strapped for cash or needed drugs, and so he had multiple young men coming to his house looking to score multiple times a day. One hustler he was very familiar with was a young man named Gene Shaw, and Gene had a friend, 25-year-old James Ferris. Now, the two would often come around and hang out, as the two loved the drug aspects of it. And one day, the two men asked Robert if he would sell them a bag of weed, and he agreed. However, a few days after selling the men the weed, police confronted Robert at his shop in the flea market and questioned him on if he sold the two men the drugs. Now, Robert felt that the men, or at least one of them, had set him up, and he believed it was James. So, of course, he denied it, and they have no way to prove it. But it was another close call, and it brought unwanted attention from police to Robert, so he was pissed. Now, this caused resentment to form in Robert against James, since he believed he was the one that ratted him out, and that only increased the more he hung around Robert's house. James and Gene would often show up uninvited, party, get drunk and high, and trash Robert's house. Now, things finally came to a head when Robert came home one day from work to discover that James and Gene had actually broken into his house and robbed him, looking for drugs. Now, Robert would later admit that this was the reason he wanted James to suffer, and that James was the only one of his victims he set out to intentionally torture. So that's another thing. After his capture, Robert stated it was never his intention to actively torture his victims. He was just testing out things that he thought would get him sexually aroused. And I guess what he meant by that was, like, his goal wasn't to torture them. It was to get sexual pleasure. And the only way he got sexual pleasure is from torturing them. And so the only one he was like, I don't care if I get sexually aroused from this. I just want to torture the dude because he pissed me off, is James. I know, really weird. Doesn't make a lick of sense.
No, he's still torturing these men. He's getting the sexual arousal off of it, not them. And he's getting it from torturing them. So, you know, the whole thing of I never set out to kill anybody and I never set out to torture anybody. Yeah, that's bullshit.
It is. But in his mind and in his fantasy, this makes complete sense. So finally, on September 26, 1985, Robert received a phone call from James asking if they could meet for a drink at a popular Kansas City gay bar called Midnight Sun. Now, once at the bar, James asked Robert if he could crash at his house for a few days while he got back on his feet, and Robert happily agreed, already formulating his plan to take James captive. Now, back at Robert's house, Robert made James a bowl of chili and crushed several sleeping pills into it. Once James passed out in a bed on the second floor, Robert injected him with several more sedatives before stripping him naked and tying his hands and feet behind his back. For 3 hours, Robert sexually assaulted James over and over before again assaulting him with carrots and cucumbers. Once James started to regain consciousness, Robert was excited to try out one of his new favorite torture methods. Robert had gotten 2 metal cooking spatulas and hooked them up to his 7,000-watt transformer, and this was in order to deliver quicker and easier shocks all over James's body, and so Robert no longer needed to stick needles all over his victim's body and then have to take them out and put them back in whenever he wanted to shock a different part of his body. So with the spatulas, they were mobile, so he could just zap, zap, zap wherever he wanted instantly. So Robert would subject James to multiple shock treatments lasting up to 5 minutes at a time. He placed the spatulas on James' genitals and on his eyes as he electrocuted him in an attempt to make him blind. With each shock treatment, James attempted to cry out and scream in agony, but he had a gag in his mouth tied into place with piano wire. However, this is when Robert noticed that even when the gag started to slip off, James didn't make much noise when he screamed. And that's when James revealed a sad and horrifically terrifying detail. He had been in a car accident when he was young, and it had actually damaged his vocal cords, which prevented him from being able to scream. This news filled Robert with so much excitement, as he no longer had to worry about gagging James or be afraid that the neighbors would hear him. So Robert continues to subject James to multiple rounds of shock treatment, only stopping to occasionally sexually assault him. So I can even imagine the horror there. Like, he realizes, like, oh, I don't have to worry about noise anymore. I can do whatever I want to, and because he physically can't scream.
That's awful.
Now, Robert would do this torture nonstop for 10 hours until the sun came up the next day. Robert checked James's temperature after he was done and noticed that James was now running a fever of over 100 degrees. Worried he may be getting sick, Robert injected James with antibiotics to help him get better. Now, over the next 27 hours, Robert continued his assaults and tortures on James. He jammed needles into his genitals, eyes, and under his fingernails, and injected him with tranquilizers throughout the day.
And this is him, like, holding back.
No, that's the thing. Like, again, if you haven't listened to part one, I would recommend you listen to it if you want the full story. But, yeah, this is him pulling back his torture, and this is after he rationalized to himself. Like, he had the self-awareness to be like, what I'm doing will kill people, and it's horrible. I don't want to kill them. I just want to torture them. So what is the best way for me to go about this and cause as much pain as possible without killing them? So he put thought into this, and that just makes it even more horrific and just shows how much of a monster he is even more.
Yeah, especially because he's thinking, I'm not torturing them. I'm just getting sexual pleasure from them.
Yeah, he's like, it's nothing personal against you. It's like, this is just the only way I can get off. And so, like, I'm sorry it had to be you, but, you know, I'm going to torture you to get myself off. But to me, it's not torture. And honestly, I think that's what makes him even more scary than a lot of other serial killers, is because a lot of times you'll see serial killers and they're like, oh, well, like, I got filled with this, every so often I get filled with this uncontrollable rage, and that's what sends me, like, to murder people, or they are just, you know, psychopaths. But with Robert, he is very self-aware and calm, and he actually has the control to be like, I'm going to stop murdering people for a few months until I can actually think of the best way to torture them without killing them. And he even said in the first part, he actually took a moment to reflect, and he was like, wow, you know, what I am doing is messed up. And he's like, I wonder why I enjoy getting off to torturing people. So he literally self-reflected on why he was a serial killer. So, super horrible dude. So, by evening of the second day of torture, James had become delirious and was barely able to sit upright or form coherent sentences. Robert wrote down in his torture journal that James' breathing had become shallow and he was starting to snore. And by midnight, Robert wrote down that James was 86, which is a popular restaurant term that means a product is no longer available or out of stock, or in this case, is dead. Robert dragged James's body to the bathtub on the third floor and slashed his arteries open in order to let the blood drain from the body before he set about dismembering his corpse.
So he was going to hold back and not torture this guy to death, hopefully, but he actually kills him in like a day. So he might self-reflect and he might think a lot on it, but he's not good at it. He's good at killing people, good at torturing people, but not good at holding back.
And that's something we'll get into here, is like, he found it hard to hold back. Like, he, during all the torture sessions, he'd like try to tell himself, like, Hold on, don't go that far, you're gonna kill him. But he literally just couldn't help it. He was so, like, sexually aroused by it, like, he just completely zoned out. So, like he had with his first three victims, Robert used a bone saw and a chainsaw to cut off James's head and limbs and cut up his torso before wrapping each piece in newspapers and stuffing them into garbage bags. After he was done, he again rolled the trash bins out to the side of the curb, where they were picked up by the trash collectors and taken to a landfill. Although Robert was again disappointed that James had only lasted 27 hours before dying, he would later state he did feel satisfied that the man he thought had ratted him out to police was now dead by his hand. Again, no one seemed to be looking for James or even seemed to be realize that he was missing, and Robert was in the clear again, and by this point, he was starting to feel cocky, and he was so sure of himself, and he was ready to go out and look for a next victim immediately. He began to cruise around Kansas City to all the popular hangout spots for the hustlers, and he was scoping each one out, trying to decide which one he wanted to take captive or which one he thought would have the best screams while being tortured. However, by this point, four men had disappeared, and the only thing that connected them was that each man was known to hang around Robert often and that they were last seen in the vicinity of his home. So word spread fast amongst the hustlers that Robert was becoming someone that needed to be avoided at all costs. So at first, it was kind of like, you know, go with him, but keep your guard up. He can be kind of shady. He might try to take advantage of you. So go with him. The money is good. The drugs are good, but just be alert at all times.
You know what you're getting into.
But now it's become this guy suspected to be involved with the disappearance of at least four men. Don't go home with them, no matter what he says, no matter how much money he offers you or drugs, avoid him. So although no one had actual physical evidence or even eyewitnesses to prove Robert was the last one to see the men, it was just one of those things that, with the context clues, they were enough, and the hustlers were smart enough to realize that something wasn't right about Robert or this whole situation. So Robert now found it difficult to get any of the hustlers into his car, which of course infuriated him. But still, Robert knew it wouldn't be long before he found someone desperate enough for money or drugs that they would ignore their own instincts and come home with him. And on June 17th, 1986, that's exactly what happened. Robert was cruising the area down by Kansas City Liberty Memorial Park, a known hangout for the hustlers, or just a little fun fact here, hustlers were also known as chicken hawks by police, which meant a young male sex worker. So Robert would often refer to them as chicken hawks. Now, as he was driving along, he would have a chance encounter with someone he had never expected to see again. 23-year-old Todd Stoops was a homeless convicted felon and drug addict who had known Robert for years by this point. The two had met back in 1984 when Robert picked up Todd and his wife off the street and offered them a room in the house to stay in while they got back on their feet. Now, Todd was working as a sex worker at the time to support him and his wife's drug habit, and Robert would later say he had fallen in love with Todd the moment he saw him. He had never been so sexually attracted to a man before, and he would later state he had often fantasized about Todd over the years. Now, for over a year, Todd and his wife lived sporadically with Robert in between their drug binges, and Robert attempted to have sex with them on several occasions, although Todd always refused as he was attempting to quit sex work and he didn't want his wife to get angry or jealous. But now finally, by the end of 1984, Todd and his wife moved out of Robert's home and the state altogether, and they kind of lost touch with Robert. So Robert never expected to see Todd again until this chance encounter by the park. So Robert spotted Todd standing on the sidewalk and pulled up beside him to talk. Now at first, Todd didn't realize who Robert was until he'd already got into the car and the two started to drive away. If he had recognized Robert at first glance, he may not have been so willing to get with Robert. Because, you see, Todd was actually the one who told Jerry Howe's father, Paul, and the detectives that they should look at Robert in connection with Jerry's disappearance. So Todd knew Robert was a bad guy, too, and he was even the one to be like, I think Robert actually might have something to do with your son going missing, so look at him. But by this point, Todd was in the car, and Robert was talking with him about the old times they used to share together and catching up. Todd revealed that he and his wife had moved to Oklahoma, where Todd eventually got arrested for drugs, and pretty soon after that, he became estranged from his wife. Now back in Kansas City, Todd had fallen into a deep drug binge, and he was back to selling himself on the street in order to get money for drugs. Robert offered to pay Todd $13 for sex, which today would be about $35, and Todd agreed to return home with Robert. The entire drive to his home, Robert could barely contain his excitement, knowing that the man he had longed for years at this point was about to be his captive. Once back at the house, Robert made Todd a sandwich laced with sleeping pills as the two just kind of made small talk, talked about life. Now, once he was asleep, Robert injected Todd with ketamine to render him unconscious before stripping him naked and again tying his hands and feet behind his back. Robert could barely contain himself as he stood over his captive and began to formulate the best plan of torture to make sure Todd survived for as long as possible. So this is when he really, like, learns to control himself. Before, he was like, I want them to live longer, so I'm going to perfect this plan. Didn't work out with his last victim, but this victim he was determined to, because this was a man he had lusted after for years at this point. So he was like, I finally have him in my clutches. He's my captive. I'm going to make sure this time I learn to control myself, because I want him to last for a long time. And horrifically, he does. So for the first 8 hours of his captivity, Todd was repeatedly sexually assaulted by Robert until Robert could no longer maintain an erection. After he was done, Robert waited until Todd started to regain consciousness and then brought out the 7,000-watt transformer. He held the metal spatulas to Todd's eyes and held them in place while shocking his eyes in an attempt to blind him and make him less likely to escape. Robert would later state he managed to get an erection again after several hours, following a new torture method he was trying, wherein he broke all of Todd's fingers by bending them backwards one at a time, telling investigators later on that he got aroused every time, quote-unquote, he heard a bone snap and Todd screamed out in pain. Robert began to beat Todd over the back and the legs with an electrical cord, only stopping to sexually assault Todd in between torture sessions. Now, despite being gagged with a cloth tied in place with piano wire, Robert was afraid Todd was making too much noise, and he decided to try and silence his screams like how James was unable to scream. So Robert filled a syringe with liquid drain cleaner and proceeded to inject it into Todd's larynx. Robert kept reminding himself that he needed to go easy at times with the torture in order to make Todd last longer, and tragically, he was able to control himself. Todd would be held captive and systematically tortured for 14 days, 2 weeks of nonstop torture. Every day, Robert spent hours shocking, beating, and assaulting Todd, taking almost 200 Polaroids of the entire ordeal and writing down each torture in his journal. Now, at one point in his journal, Robert noted that about 8 days into his captivity, Todd asked for a sandwich and a glass of water, and when Robert told him no, he burst into tears. Robert then responded with, "You're never leaving, Todd, and these are the facts of life." Robert explained that if he tried to resist or fight back, his torture would only get worse and that he needed to obey and be a quote-unquote good slave if he wanted it to stop. Over the course of his captivity, Todd's appearance changed dramatically. His long, curly hair was shaved off because it kept getting tangled in the restraint. He grew emaciated due to his lack of food or water, and his body and face began swollen from the continued beatings. Now, extreme trigger warning for this next part, because it's like the most horrific thing, one of the most horrific things I've ever read. 10 days into his captivity on June 27th, and again, horrific, Robert noted in his journal that he had been able to shove his entire fist into Todd's anus and leave it there for several minutes without any sort of lubrication. He went on to write that he had now become very concerned as Todd's anus would not stop bleeding, and by the next day, it had become infected and Todd was running a fever. Worried Todd may die, Robert injected him with antibiotics before feeding him ice cream and soda. However, Todd was unable to hold any of it down. Even with Todd severely sick, Robert didn't stop his torture. He no longer could anally assault Todd due to the extensive wounds to his rectum, and instead used the friction by rubbing up against his body to masturbate. On July 1st, Todd was having trouble breathing, sitting upright, and so Robert put him in a bath to clean him up, afterwards tying him to a chair so he wouldn't fall over. Later that evening, Todd would pass away strapped to the chair due to septic shock caused by Robert rupturing Todd's anal wall with his fist. Again, Robert followed the same routine of draining Todd's body of blood, cutting it into multiple tiny pieces and stuffing it in garbage bags. However, the trash collectors would not be running for several days, and so Robert stored Todd's severed body parts in a freezer in the basement until the trash was collected on July 7th, and his remains were taken to the landfill like Robert's four other victims. Again, no one seemed to be looking for Todd or know that he was missing, and Robert was in the clear once again. And I know, again, this is a rough case, y'all, like I said, and I hope you're hanging in there. It's almost over. Robert goes on to claim one more victim following Todd, and then we'll have ended up back where we started at the beginning of episode one. So let's just power through this because I know this is a rough one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the next 11 months following Todd's murder, Robert maintained a low profile while searching for his next target. He ran his antique shop in the flea market during the day, and at night he prowled the streets of Kansas City looking for any hustler that was willing to get in the car with him. So at this point, he was being very picky and meticulous with his selection of victims, but now they're all privy, like they're on to him, like, we know you are a shady mofo, we can't prove that you like murdered these men, but we know you had something to do with it. So everyone's steering clear. So now he's just looking for any one of them that's desperate enough to get in the car with him. Now eventually he did start finding people that would get in the car with him, and he picked up and took several hustlers home during this time. However, he would later state that he didn't feel the desire to keep any of them captive, and he would continue to patiently wait for the right one to come along. So that's another thing, too. He can control himself hardcore. Multiple times during these 11 months after his last victim, multiple men, he got them to come home with him. You know, he could have very easily did the exact same thing he did to his first five victims, but he was able to literally be like, I'm not really feeling the desire. Like, I want to have sex with this one, but I'm not feeling desire to, like, keep them captive and, like, torture them. So I'm just let them go, drop them back off where I found them. And he was like, I am willing to wait till I find the right one. Like, I'm not in any hurry. By the spring of 1987, Robert made the acquaintance of a young man, 20-year-old Larry Pearson. Now, unlike with his previous victims, Larry wasn't a sex worker, and instead had made Robert's acquaintance upon entering his antique store at the flea market. Larry and Robert began to bond over Larry's interest in the occult and witchcraft, and pretty soon that blossomed into a seemingly genuine friendship. Larry did suffer from drug addiction and was often homeless, and Robert offered to allow him to stay at his home while he looked for work. Now, Larry did chores around the house and did yard work in place of rent, and for a few months, things actually were pretty good. Robert described Larry as being very soft-spoken and polite, and for the first few months of their friendship, Robert stated the thought of kidnapping Larry never even crossed his mind. And again, that's another thing too. He had multiple people living in the house with him in between these horrific murders and tortures, so he is able to control himself that much. However, Robert changed his mind about Larry in June of 1987. One evening in early June, Larry called Robert and asked if he would pay Larry's $150 bond to get him out of jail. Larry had actually been arrested for indecent exposure after flashing several cars on the interstate during a drug-fueled binge. Now, Robert agreed to pay it, but only on the condition that Larry travel with him to Ohio to visit Robert's family. Larry agreed and was bailed out of jail and spent the next week with Robert and his family in Ohio. Now, upon returning to Kansas City, Robert stated that this is when he really began making plans to hold Larry captive because, according to him, Larry showed no interest in finding a job or helping around the house anymore. And that infuriated him. And that's another thing, too, is that he always kind of had some rationale behind it. Like, oh, these are drug addicts, these are sex workers.
Even though he's a drug addict himself.
That too. He is a hardcore drug addict and alcoholic himself. And so, pot's calling the kettle black here.
Yeah, he just finds an excuse because he starts to... So, his willpower just starts to finally go away, and he finds a reason to say these people deserve to be tortured to death.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not torturing them, I'm just getting off sexually on them.
And so, yeah, he's just rationalizing each one of his victims. Like, oh, well, I tried to help them. I gave them money and let them stay at my house, and they're taking advantage of me. So, like, they don't deserve to live. They deserve to be horrifically tortured because I feel like they're taking advantage of me. So, on June 23rd, 1987, Robert and Larry spent the day together getting lunch before going to the theater and seeing a showing of the movie Creepshow 2. Now, afterwards, the two drove around Kansas City enjoying the nice day when they happened to pass by a corner where several gay hustlers were standing. Larry made a passing remark about how when he was living in Wichita, he and his friends used to beat up and rob homosexuals for fun, which, really shitty thing to do, but it does not justify what happens to him later, because this filled Robert with an uncontrollable rage, and it's at that point he used that to justify, like, okay, that's enough for me to be like, you deserve to be tortured. So that evening, Robert began to supply Larry with alcohol until he was nearly blackout drunk, and then proceeded to inject him with sedatives to render him unconscious. Now, Larry was heavier and larger than the previous five men had been, and Robert couldn't move him or carry him upstairs like he had the others, and instead he decided to clear a spot in the basement to keep Larry. After dragging him to the basement, Robert stripped Larry nude before binding his feet and hands with piano wire and, like he had with Todd, injecting liquid drain cleaner into Larry's larynx in an attempt to keep him from screaming. Now, Robert spent the next several hours sexually assaulting Larry, and then again, using the transformer to administer electric shocks all over his body, including his eyes and genitals. He stuck several needles into the nerves of Larry's arms and proceeded to crush the bones in his right hands with a metal rod while masturbating over top of him. Robert explained his rules to Larry and told him to follow them unless he wanted his torture to increase. This included only talking when Robert spoke to him first, and that he could never say no or resist sex at any point. Breaking these rules would result in severe punishment, which included having his testicles shocked upwards for 10 minutes. This torture went on for 5 straight days, and during this time, Larry actually put up little resistance or struggle. He was by far the most cooperative of Robert's victims, and by the end of the 5th day, Robert began to feel like Larry was accepting his new life as a sex slave. As a reward, Robert gave Larry a mattress to sleep on before eventually moving him upstairs to the bedroom on the 2nd floor. To do this, to move him from the basement to the room, Robert actually tied a dog collar around his neck and led him up on a dog leash. And during all of it, Larry put up no fight. Now, once moved to the 2nd floor bedroom, it was there Robert explained that Larry was to be his sex slave and that he was to refer to Robert as Master Bob or else he would be punished. He stated that if Larry continued to cooperate, his torture would become less and less severe and he wouldn't have to go back to the cold basement. Larry stated he understood and over the next week eventually gained Robert's trust even more to the point that Robert allowed him to watch TV and remain in the bedroom. Larry was held prisoner for 6 weeks, enduring multiple sexual assaults each day along with the electroshock torture. And during this time, Larry continued to cooperate and even began to make himself moan in pleasure and tell Robert how much he loved having sex with him, which really made Robert happy. So Larry was smart. He knew to play the game. He knew Robert, this sicko, got off on him resisting, screaming. So he was like, I got to play into it. So even though Robert was horrifically assaulting him every day, he was like, he wants me to, you know, be into it. So I'm going to lie to him and be like, oh yeah, this is great. And that just made Robert trust him more. Larry also trained himself to sleep without moving as not to wake Robert or anger him. And he seemed to accept his new life, according to Robert. So by early August, Robert had begun to trust Larry enough that each morning he would bring Larry downstairs to have breakfast with him before he went to work. After breakfast, Larry was to crawl under the table and perform oral sex on Robert, and he did so without a fight. Robert had stopped torturing Larry at this point and only shocked him if he broke the house rules, and he began to let his guard down around Larry. Now, here's a little bit of sweet, sweet revenge. On the morning of August 5th, Robert was enjoying his coffee in the morning while reading the newspaper and receiving oral sex from Larry, when all of a sudden, he felt a jolt of pain coming from his genitals. Robert looked down to see that Larry had bitten down on his penis as hard as he could. Robert picked up a wooden stick and began to beat Larry over the head until he let go. Larry screamed that he wouldn't live like this anymore before Robert continued to beat him over the head and back with the stick so that he could quote-unquote feel what it felt like. So Larry played the long game, and then he was like, you know what? I'm not going to live like this anymore, and if I have to die, I'm going to make sure that I try to mutilate you. The most important thing to you, which is his penis, is like, I'm going to make sure that I take that prick off, literally. And so he tried his best. So Robert beat Larry into unconsciousness before tying him up on the kitchen floor and leaving him there while he drove himself to the nearby hospital. Now at the hospital, doctors stitched up Robert's penis, which had several very deep gashes on it, and it was bleeding profusely. They told him that he would need to stay at the hospital for several days while the wound healed, but Robert refused and checked himself out, knowing that if Larry woke up, he could easily escape and call police. He used the excuse that he needed to go home and take care of his dogs, but would return in a few hours. And he, which also, side note, I don't think it's ever brought up what Robert told the doctors what happened. Like, this man came in with human teeth marks around his penis, so I'm very interested to know the story, the bullshit story he gave the doctors. But it's never brought up anywhere, but this is one of those things I'm curious about. Now, upon returning home, Robert found Larry still tied up and passed out on the floor, his body now covered in bruises from his beating. While at the hospital, doctors told Robert that he wouldn't be able to have sex for several weeks, and until then, he would suffer very painful erections. This angered him beyond measure, and he decided that if he couldn't have sex, he no longer needed Larry. Robert grabbed a plastic bag from the kitchen and wrapped it tightly around Larry's head, holding it in place with a rope, suffocating him to death. After he was sure he was dead, Robert left him lying on the kitchen floor for 3 days while he went back to the hospital to recover. Before he left, Robert had turned the AC all the way up, hoping that the cold would slow down Larry's decomposition. So again, well, first of all, what happened to that? I never set out to kill any of my victims. They all, you know, like, that defeats the purpose of what I wanted them for. So he's, again, just proving how much of a hypocrite and how deranged he actually is. But at the same time, how calculating and methodical he is, because he had the forethought, again, even though his penis is half bitten off, he was like, I'm going to be gone for a few days. There's a dead body in my house. This is the middle of summer. I'm going to crank the AC up all the way just to slow down the decomposition process as much as possible. Now, once back at the house, Robert, who had now had to use a catheter at this point, and that just shows you how bad it was, dragged Larry's body down to the basement to begin the dismemberment process. Unlike past victims, Robert didn't need to drain the body of blood first, as by this point it had congealed and solidified. Due to his injuries, Robert had to take his time cutting up the body and exclusively used a chainsaw with dismembering Larry, noting in his journal how easily the bones and flesh slip away from the body after it's been sitting there for a few days. After 2 days of cutting up Larry's body and wrapping the pieces in trash bags, Robert decided to keep another souvenir and thus kept Larry's severed head as a trophy, keeping it in his freezer for a week before digging up Sheldon's head buried in the backyard and replacing it with Larry's. He then cleaned Sheldon's skull at this point and kept it on his bookshelf.
He is just blatantly throwing it out there now.
And that's another thing, too. A lot of times you see with these serial killers, it's like, they're so meticulous at first to make sure they don't get caught. Even with Robert, like the first person he killed, he made sure there was no evidence that that person was ever there. He didn't keep any souvenirs or trophy, but the more they get away with these murders and the less they think police are onto them, the more cocky they get. And that's usually why it comes back to bite them in the ass.
Or in the dick
in this case. And it's like, good, I hope that hurt like hell. So the trash bags containing Larry were also set on the curb for pickup and taken to the landfill like his previous 5 victims. Again, no one suspected him or was even looking for Larry as far as he could tell, and he had gotten away with it. He immediately went back to searching around for his next victim, even though his penis is half bitten off, prowling the streets at night looking for any hustler that might make good captives. Now, he did this for several more months before finally settling on his next target, the night of March 29th, 1988. That night, Robert was doing his usual routine of looking for a hustler. However, by this point, he was finding it hard to get any of them to even talk to him. Everyone who had been hustling for a while knew by now that they were to avoid the man in the wire-brimmed glasses at all costs. No matter how much money he offered you, or drugs, don't go home with him, because five men have now vanished after last being seen with him. Now, except that was a fact unknown to the fairly new hustler, 22-year-old Christopher Bryson. As Chris stood on the street, Robert pulled up beside him and asked if he would like to party. Chris agreed and hopped into the car, and the two spent the next hour or so driving around, drinking, and getting high. Finally, Robert offered to pay Chris for sex, and he agreed, so the two drove back to Robert's home. Once at the house, the two chatted some more before Robert asked if Chris wanted to go upstairs and watch some TV in the bedroom. Now, as Chris walked up the stairs, Robert grabbed a metal pipe sitting against the wall and smashed Chris across the head with it, knocking him back down the stairs. Now, once he fell, Robert quickly injected him with a tranquilizer and knocked him out. And that's another weird thing, too. He never really stated why he kind of changed his MO up, because before he always, like, crushed sleeping pills or something in their sandwiches, or, like, got him so drunk to the point they blacked out. So this is...
Risky. He's taking more risks this time.
He's escalating, and he's taking more risks, and now he's just whacking them on the head. And at the same time, risking killing them, because a hit to the head is very seriously, especially with a metal pipe. So Robert first dragged Chris to the bathroom, where he stripped him naked in the bathtub and took several Polaroids before dragging him to the bedroom and tying him to the bed. Once tied to the bed, Robert masturbated over top of Chris before attempting to gouge out his right eye with his bare hands, but thankfully failed to do so. The next morning when Chris woke up, Robert started his torture by dipping Q-tips into liquid drain cleaner and using them to swab over Chris's eyes in an attempt to blind him. After that, he began to smash Chris's hands with a metal pipe while masturbating, breaking several bones in his hands. Robert paused his torture and calmly explained to his new victim, stating, actually, you read this, Brad.
You did not choose to be here, but you are. For you to survive being here and for you to, you know, make it, it can either be rough or it can be easy. If I grow to like you and learn to trust you, then I can do special things for you, like buy you cigarettes, pick up a movie on the way home from work, and so forth. Don't try and fight me, or you'll just get more of what you had earlier. You see, what you got is nothing compared to what you can have. The only things you need to think about are me and this house. What a nice man. He'll get him cigarettes and pick up a movie before torturing him.
But that's the thing, too, is all his neighbors described him as being very sweet and generous. He always smiled and waved at them. He was quiet and kept to himself, but they thought he, you know, he was just a man that valued his privacy. But if he saw you, he was very warm and friendly. So Robert proceeded to inject drain cleaner into Chris's larynx in an attempt to silence his screams before hooking alligator clamps to his testicles and shocking him. Now, for the next 8 hours, Robert alternated between torturing Chris and sexually assaulting him over and over, reminding him every so often that the more he tried to resist, the worse the torture would become. Robert explained the rules to Chris, stating he is not to speak unless spoken to. If he tries to bite Robert, then he will have all of his teeth removed without any anesthetic. And if he tries to fight back or run, then Robert will break his arms in half and not reset them, so they will heal twisted and mangled. Now, by the next day, Robert actually began talking with Chris about his personal life, and Chris revealed he actually had a wife and son at home, and that he was hustling to get more money to support them. Robert would hook a leather dog collar around Chris's neck and use a leash to guide him to the bathroom every few hours between torture sessions. So on top of constantly reminding Chris of the rules, Robert also showed him the hundreds of Polaroids he had taken of his previous victims being tortured and murdered to show Chris that he wasn't joking around. Like his previous other six victims, Chris's torture was documented with dozens of Polaroids and notes in Robert's torture journals. Robert wrote multiple notes where he stated that he was excited and even hopeful, since Chris was being more cooperative than the previous men, and he seemed to accept his new fate. Now, within a few days of being taken captive, Robert stated that he was actually starting to trust Chris, And so he rewarded Chris by bringing him a TV to watch. Although the extreme torture started to subside, Robert made it clear he would have sex with Chris in the morning before work and after work when he got home, and he is not to put up any sort of fight. Chris seemed to accept all of this, and pretty soon a routine was developed between the two, with Robert assaulting Chris in the mornings and evenings, but otherwise the torture had finally stopped. Eventually, Robert began to trust Chris so much that when he went to work, instead of drugging Chris like he had his previous victims, Robert would allow Chris to remain awake and watch TV, but made sure to tie his hands and his feet tightly to the bed. He also warned Chris, "I've gotten this far with people before, and they're dead now because of mistakes they made." So after several more days of this routine, Chris asked Robert if he wouldn't mind tying his hands to his side instead of above his head because it cut off his circulation. Robert agreed, and instead of tying Chris's hands to the bedpost, he tied them to the restraints around his ankles. Now in this position, Chris realized that with his hands in this position, he could potentially work them free. However, he also knew that he had to be smart about it, because if Robert caught him trying to escape, there would be hell to pay. So for two more days, Chris kept his cool and didn't try to escape, and instead continued to act like he had accepted his role as a sex slave. But finally, on his fourth day of captivity, Robert left for work that morning, and Chris knew it was now or never. So for several hours, Chris frantically worked at the ropes around his wrists, tugging and pulling, but found that Robert had tied them too tightly. Thinking fast, Chris noticed something sitting on the nightstand by the bed. So Robert had gotten Chris a pack of cigarettes, you know, like he promised, being so generous, the day before, and he had forgotten to take the matches with him when he left. So Chris grabbed the matches and slowly began to use them to burn away the ropes around his wrists. Finally free, and that just shows you, like, how smart, like, quick-thinking Chris was. Like, this panic, he's like, this man could come home at any point, and he's already subjected me. Also, he's already had drain cleaner poured into his eyes.
And injected into his larynx.
And injected into his larynx, and through, I can't even imagine how painful that is. And through all that, he's able to be like, there's matches, I can use those to burn through the ropes. You gotta be smart about it, patient about it. So finally free, Chris crawled out onto the roof of the house, fully nude, except for the dog collar still around his neck, and jumped to the ground below, breaking his ankle in the process. He spotted a meter man across the street and ran to him screaming to call the police. And with that, we are back to where we started this case at the beginning of last week. Police arrived a few minutes after the 911 call and began to interview Chris, and he, again, very smartly, told them that Robert had actually picked him up hitchhiking and that he took him back to the house where he raped and tortured him for 4 days. So Chris would later say that he knew if he told officers he was a sex worker, they were probably less likely to put as much effort into investigating Robert.
Or they're going to say, this is a lover's spat and give him back to him, which has happened in quite a few cases.
Or do that. So he's fully aware. He's like, I am a gay sex worker. If I tell them that, they're probably, if this is the 80s, they're probably not going to put that much effort into it and be like, oh, you know, it's just a disgruntled sex worker. He may have not paid him or something. So he's inventing this whole story. So again, through the pain and all this, I can't imagine how afraid he was able to be like, pause, let me think of what I'm actually going to tell police. So as Chris was taken to a hospital to be treated for his wounds, police waited across the street for Robert to return home. And in less than 20 minutes, he pulled into the driveway. So again, that just shows you how close Chris was to almost not escaping. 20 minutes, that's all he had. The officers approached Robert, and after confirming all of his details, they arrested him for alleged sexual assault and asked him to come down to the station. When asked if he could search his home, he declined. Now, but within an hour, officers obtained a search warrant, and they returned to Robert's house to go inside and look around. Immediately, they knew something wasn't right. The house was filthy. Dog feces was all over the floor, rotten food and roaches were everywhere. Officers found the second floor bedroom where Chris had been kept and confirmed his story, and on a bookshelf in the hallway, one officer turned to come face to face with a human skull, the one belonging to Robert Sheldon. Now, also in the room where Chris was held, officers found a box of Polaroids that showed not only Chris in various poses and torture, but multiple other unidentified men, both alive and what appeared to be dead. Photos of men with various objects protruding from their rectums, dozens of photos of nude men hung upside down in the basement and being drained of blood. In total, 400 Polaroids were found of men being tortured and seemingly murdered, on top of at least four journals filled with descriptions of the torture by Robert. A chainsaw was found to be stained with blood, flesh, and pubic hair. An luminol test revealed the basement floor was covered with blood stains. So by this point, officers' hearts started to sink as they began to realize that they may actually have another John Wayne Gacy on their hands. A backhoe was brought in to dig up the backyard, and within minutes, it unearthed the decomposing skull of Larry Pearson, and officers knew that they had a killer on their hands. The driver's license for Jerry Howell and James Ferris was found inside of a box in the hallway closet, and to help identify all the men in the Polaroids, police actually began to show them around to all the male street hustlers, and pretty soon they were able to confirm the identities of the men as being Robert's six previous victims. Now, thanks to dental records, officers were able to positively ID the skull found buried in the backyard as having belonged to Larry Pearson. Sadly, Robert had actually taken all the teeth out from Sheldon's skull, so they weren't able to positively ID it, but Robert confirmed that it was Robert Sheldon's. Now, as news broke about all the horrors discovered on Charlotte Street, Kansas City erupted into a frenzy as news crews and reporters swarmed the house, and officers felt confident they had enough circumstantial evidence to officially charge Robert. Robert was charged with the murder and dismemberment of Larry Pearson, as well as 9 counts of sodomy for the assault of Chris Bryson. Hoping to avoid a trial, Robert opted to take a plea bargain from prosecutors, who agreed that if Robert walked them through every detail about his victims and the tortures he subjected them to, they would not seek the death penalty. Robert confessed every detail I just described to you over the course of these 2 episodes, and explained his desire to create the perfect sex slave he could do whatever he wanted to. And on December 19, 1988, Robert was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder in connection with Larry Pearson and Robert Sheldon, and 4 counts of second-degree murder and sexual assault. So, sadly, although Robert confessed the names and details of all his victims and their murders, and despite police conducting extensive searches for the remains of the bodies of Jerry Howell, Mark Wallace, James Ferris, and Todd Stoops, none of them were ever found, and they had been lost in the landfill. The only parts recovered of Larry and Sheldon, of course, being their heads, because Robert decided to keep them as trophies. So that's why they only charged him with first-degree murder in connection with Larry and Robert Sheldon, is because the other victims, although there's photographic proof, they don't have a body. Hard to get a first-degree murder conviction without a body. So following his conviction and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, Robert was housed at the Missouri State Penitentiary, where he would often grant interviews to reporters and write letters with anyone who wanted to write him. He maintained that although he had made a few mistakes in his past, he was working towards being a better person in prison. And, you know, it's like, sir, you committed some of the worst atrocities I've ever heard. That's not a mistake. Robert was also very vocal about how he felt railroaded by the media and police, and that he thinks he didn't receive fair treatment during his sentencing. He often complained to officials that prison conditions were less than ideal, and he didn't like it. So, again, that's just one of those things that pisses you off. Like, he did all this to his victims, and he was very much did not give an F about it. He was like, this is your life now, get used to it. But then he's like, well, you know, the conditions in prison are really not up to par. You know, they could be better. I feel like I'm not being treated fairly. Now, Robert continued to grant interviews throughout his final years, and never once did he express any remorse for what he did, and even continued to refer to his victims as his quote-unquote play toys whenever talking about them to reporters in prison. So Robert was eventually diagnosed as a sexual sadist and as having depressive personality disorder. And if you listen to part one, he did have a pretty weird, rough childhood there for a minute in his teenage years, but none of that excuses what he did, like at all. This man is beyond anything I've ever read. Now, on October 8th, 1992, Robert began complaining about chest pains to prison guards, and he was taken to the infirmary, where an ambulance was called to transport him to a hospital a few minutes down the road. However, upon arriving at about 3:55 p.m., Robert was pronounced dead from a heart attack at the age of 43. When the judge that oversaw his case was informed of his death, he chuckled and stated, "It couldn't have happened to a better guy." Now, all of Robert's possessions were auctioned off in November of 1988, raising almost $200,000 from bidders all across the country. Robert's house, where all the murders occurred, was purchased by a local Kansas City company and demolished in November of 1988. Now, although he may not be as well known as Dahmer or Gacy, Robert's crimes and the unspeakable acts he committed against his victims are still haunting the Kansas City queer community, and they remain an extremely dark spot in their history. During the last interview Robert gave just a few days before his death, he stated, "The papers and media have portrayed me as non-human. Their motivation is not separate from how I treated my victims. This is what the media has done to me. It has dehumanized me so that it can believe that Satanism, demonic practices, and human sacrifice are more believable than me being the neighbor next door, who simply reached a point in his life where he could do monstrous acts. This isn't the same as being a monster." And that is the horrific case of Robert Burdella, a.k.a. the Kansas City Butcher.
I love how he complains that they're dehumanizing him as he was trying to blind people so they couldn't see and run away, as he was trying to inject stuff into their larynx so that they couldn't speak. I think that is dehumanizing someone. I mean, this person was awful. I hate to say it, but like, these have been my two least favorite episodes that we have done. It's just, this is very hard to listen to. This man was such a sadist and everything. All the cases are awful, and I always hate that anybody dies or anything like this, but this man was just awful, and the entire time I'm just sitting here pissed off at this person. So, yeah, I'm kind of glad this is over.
Yeah, this is a very extremely rough case to cover, and it is difficult, but again, it's one of those cases that I feel needs more attention because, like I said, he's not as well known as Dahmer or Gacy. If you're deep in the trenches of, you know, love listening and reading true crime, you probably heard of him just because, again, how horrific his crimes were. But I think in the overall public zeitgeist, he's not as well known as Dahmer or Gacy because he didn't have as many victims. You know, he only killed 6 people that we know of. But just what he did to them and his whole rationale and psychological reasoning behind it is so bizarre and fascinating to me. And the fact that everything he did, he rationalized in his mind. So on top of, like, you know, I'm torturing them to get sexual satisfaction, he rationalized him kidnapping them and torturing them by being like, well, they're a drug addict. They robbed from me, so this is karma.
They didn't pay me back.
Or they didn't pay me $150 back. So it's just one of those things, is like, how far some people will go to justify their actions, even though it's like, clearly, sir, you are a monster that at this point is beyond help. Like, this man was, there was no helping him. There was no rehabilitation. He deserved to rot in prison. And sadly, he only was in prison for like 4 years before he died. And so he didn't get to get punished too much, which sucks, but maybe he's getting punished in the afterlife if you believe in that sort of thing. So we can only hope. But with that, thank you guys again so much for tuning in for another week. Sorry, this was a really rough case.
Understand? Really rough two cases.
A really rough two cases. One case split into two. But understand, it kind of hard to listen to these types of cases. But I also think it's, again, important that we talk about them, because these are especially lesser known cases, and especially just cases like this, because it's just so hard to believe that there are people out there that are this evil and that exist, and they do. So we got to watch your back.
And I mean, the lesson to take away from this really is, you know, you can end up somebody's sex slave very easily by just going into their house, accepting a drink or accepting food from them, from someone you don't know. Yeah, these were a lot of them sex workers and everything like that. But now with the apps and everything else out there, if this guy had the apps, could you imagine how many people, like, he wouldn't have to look for anybody. He could just have them come over to the house and have a new sex slave every week. It's actually really scary. And I would say it happens a lot more than we know.
Oh, it happens quite a bit. There's a few cases on the list of future episodes that are all centered around people picking up their victims off Grindr. Especially if you're using the apps out there, have fun, but be careful. Always be on guard, especially if you're going to a stranger's house to hook up or just to talk or be friends or whatever you're doing.
And if your gut ever tells you, get out of here, get out of there. That's like the guy that he had actually told the police, this guy is the guy you're probably looking for, or told the family of the victims that this is probably who they need to look at. And he still went home with this guy because he had gotten to the car with him. I think what I would have done, as soon as that door opened, when that car stopped, I would have run down the street and run off. But he didn't, and he didn't trust his gut. And that's something horrible happened to him. I hate that.
But also, especially with, like, in that case, Robert wasn't an idiot. He knew to target people that were very addicted to drugs, homeless, destitute. And so that was the case with, like, Todd Stoops. Like, he knew Robert was a shady dude and was probably more than likely connected to the disappearance of at least one man. However, he was so desperate for drugs that he was willing to throw away his gut instinct to be like, I'm going to risk it because there's potentially money at the end of this for me to get drugs. And that's just the sad reality too, is that one, drug addiction is horrible and how it completely clouds your judgment and everything else. And Robert knew that and took full advantage of it, because again, most of his victims were sex workers, and not only were they sex workers, but they were drug addicts. And it's a sad reality, and it's even shittier even more because Robert knew these people were down on their luck and they were desperate and they were in a rough spot in their life, and he decided to take advantage of that. So he's just an all around horrible, horrible man. Thank God he's dead. So again, thank you guys so much for tuning in for another week. If you like this episode and enjoy the podcast, please rate us 5 stars or leave us a review on Spotify or iTunes or wherever it is you're listening to us at. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast, helps more people listen. The more people listen, the more we rise up the charts, hopefully. So also, we're still wanting to put together the listener experience tale episode, like bonus episode. So if you have a personal creepy or spooky account that you would like to share with us and have read on the podcast, you can message it to us on our socials, on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast, or email it to us. I had a brain fog there. Email it to us at beerswithqueerspodcast@gmail.com, and I'll have that linked in the show notes. And until next Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you guys.
Bye.